The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Well, in just about another month, you're going to have a lot of students graduating from high school. As parents, many will be looking at the cost of sending their children to school. And as we've known over the last couple decades, the cost of a college education has escalated over the years, becoming quite expensive, leaving many students with high debt burdens when they graduate. What can a parent do in terms of obtaining financial aid, and what is the best way to finance a college education? Joining me as my special guest today is Kathy Ruby. She's Director of College Finance at College Coach. And Kathy, why don't we begin, as parents are looking at financial aid cost or the cost of college, there are a lot of financial aid packages that are out there, and sometimes that can be confusing. Why don't we start with the basics? What should they be looking for when they're looking at a financial aid package?
Okay, well, lots of things to be looking at. And I'm assuming at this point they've already applied for admission and they've got a financial aid award in front of them. So when they're looking at a financial aid award, of course, the first thing to understand is how much does the college cost? So most colleges will list their costs, their tuition and their fees and their room and board. Those are the direct costs that a family will be responsible for. But then some colleges will also list indirect costs on a financial aid award. So they'll include things like books and personal expenses and transportation. And those estimates can really vary from college to college. But it's important, I think, as you're looking at a financial aid award, to keep in your mind what are the costs to attend that particular school, and then what are the discretionary sort of personal costs that are going to be there no matter what college my child goes to. So that's the first step. And then to look at the different types of aid that are offered. The first type, of course, the best kind of money are grants and scholarships, which are the money that doesn't have to be repaid, right? The free money. And when you're looking at a grant and a scholarship that's been offered, you really want to understand why it was offered. Was it based on academic merit or was it based on financial need? And that's a pretty important distinction. The difference being academic merit scholarships are awarded based on your child's academic profile as they relate to other students at that college. And so for those kinds of awards, usually there's a GPA requirement that is attached to that scholarship in order for it to be renewed every year. So of course, when you're looking at a financial aid award, you want to always have in the back of your mind, what's this going to look like for 4 years, right? So academic scholarships generally have a GPA requirement attached. So you're going to want to understand what that GPA requirement is and whether or not it's reasonable. I mean, is it 3.8 or is it 3.0? There's a big difference there. So academic merit scholarships, understanding that piece. And then when it comes to need-based grants, those are grants that are awarded based on your family's financial situation, based on income, assets, your household size, how many kids in your household are enrolled in college. So you really want to read through the terms and conditions of the award to find out how likely it is that that grant's going to be renewed every year. Most colleges will say things like, you know, as long as your financial situation stays the same each year, you can expect that this grant will be renewed. But for some families, they may know their income's going to go up, or maybe they have two kids in college right now, but they know the older one's going to graduate. So if you're anticipating financial changes in the upcoming 4 years, you're going to want to contact that financial aid office to see if they can give you an idea of how that might affect a need-based grant that's been awarded. So when it comes to the grants and scholarships, it's all about renewability.
So I know some colleges have different aid packages. One would be like for outright scholarship grant where they cover the cost of education, books, and housing. Other colleges offer what they call some kind of work program where part of the cost required that the student do some kind of work on college. Can you explain the differences in these kind of different aid packages? In other words, outright, let's say, coverage of the cost, a loan, or a work program?
Yes. So grants and scholarships, of course, the best kind because it's free money that doesn't have to be repaid. Work obviously requires some effort on the student's behalf. So work study is sometimes offered as part of a financial aid package. And the reason it's considered financial aid is that the government actually gives money to schools to help them pay students who work on campus. So the students who are offered work study on campus are usually students who have financial need because colleges prioritize that needy students get that money first. And so when you see a work study award within a financial aid award, what that amount represents is the maximum that the student's going to be allowed to earn. So it's usually something like $2,000 or $3,000. And so your next questions are, you know, how many hours a week will my student have to work to earn that? Is it 10 hours a week? Is it 15 hours a week? So you'll have to read through the terms of the award to find out what their wage rate is. You'll also want to find out how easily can my student get a job? Because that answer really varies from college to college. Because some colleges will assign every student who has work study, they'll assign them a job. But more commonly, colleges will say, okay, you have work study. That gives you the right to go find a job on campus using this, you know, online student employment board or whatever it might be. So you really want to ask those questions about how does my student find a job? How many hours a week will they have to work to earn this money? The important thing to know about work study is that that award is not guaranteed. The student has to actually work to earn that money. And then most colleges actually don't let you apply the money directly to the bill because they know that sometimes kids don't earn what they think they're going to earn. So usually that money, it's a part-time job and the student gets paid a couple times a month or once a month. And that money is usually used to help pay for books and personal expenses, but it's not necessarily used to pay the bill at the college. So that's what work study is. Now, also important to know, if you were not offered work study in a financial aid award, that doesn't necessarily mean that your student can't work on campus. Because, as I said, work study is awarded to needy students, and many colleges have more jobs available than they have needy students to fill them. So many times they'll open up student employment to anybody who wants to work. It may just be that work study students get priority in hiring, and then other students can go find jobs that are not offered to work study students. Having worked in several colleges, I can tell you that food service jobs are often open in colleges because it's not a place that a lot of kids love to work, but it can be a place where you can get the hours that you need and earn the money that you want to earn. So I think another thing for parents to think about is that there is actually research that shows that kids who work in school and college actually do better academically. And when we say that, we don't mean working 20 or 30 or 40 hours a week, but 10 to 15 hours a week is a way that it helps students structure their time. Because when they get to college, you know, they're only in class 15 hours a week and they think they've got lots of time. So having a job helps them structure their time. It gives them another connection to their college that's different from their faculty-student interactions. Lots of good reasons to work. And there are a variety of ways to do it. So for families who don't have work study in their award, they can certainly approach the student employment office at a college to find out about what other kinds of jobs are available.
When we're talking about financial aid, are there any tips or special things a parent or a student may do that may increase their likelihood of getting a financial aid offer?
Yes, there definitely are things they can do. I think when families ask me, how can I maximize the chance of my student getting a scholarship or grant to help pay for college, my response is always, it's all about the list of colleges that your student applies to. So when it comes to getting financial aid, while certainly the government plays a role in providing student loans and providing grants to very needy families, the colleges themselves are the biggest source of money, really. So understanding how a college awards their financial aid is key to maximizing how much your student will get. And there are a couple of themes there. Now, we've talked about there are need-based grants and scholarships, and those are based on your family's ability to pay. And then there are also merit scholarships that colleges offer, and those are based on your student's academic profile within the profile of students who are at that college. So let's focus on merit scholarships first. Colleges offer scholarships to students to entice them to enroll. I mean, that's the market reality of it. We like to think scholarships are offered to reward our kids' great achievements, and that is true. but they're also offered to entice students to enroll. So, you know, every college has a profile of their students, and they're always trying to build that profile. So where your child is most likely to receive scholarships is at the colleges where they're most likely to get in. So as your child is putting together their list of colleges that they're considering, you know, college admission experts will tell you, you want to have a group of colleges that are going to be no problem for your student to get into, and then you want to have a group that are sort of just right. They're on target, sort of a 50-50 chance. And then, of course, all students have their challenging or their reach colleges that they're working toward. But the colleges that are no problem for your student to get into, where their profile, what their test scores, their GPA, their academic profile is in the top quartile of students admitted at that college, and that college has a selectivity rate that makes your student very attractive to them, those are the places that are the most likely to award scholarships to your student. The colleges where they're reaching for, those colleges know that they don't have to offer much money to entice your kind of student to enroll because they're a reach college for that student. So it's all about having a well-shaped list. I have a friend who describes it as a pyramid, to have, you know, a few colleges, four colleges that are no problem, and then maybe three that are just right, and then two that are reaches. There's no exact number there, but you get the idea.
So when applying for these scholarships, you said there's some on merit, there's academic scholarships, but also aren't there need scholarships as well?
Yes, absolutely. So colleges administer need-based financial aid, and certainly I think that's the more traditional kind of aid that we hear about. And need-based financial aid is awarded based on a somewhat simple formula at first, but it gets more complicated than that. So colleges assess your financial need or determine your family's financial need by starting with their cost of attendance. So each college is required to establish a cost of attendance that includes tuition and fees, books and personal expenses, and room and board, even if your student is living off campus. So important to remember, your student can receive financial aid for room and board even if they're living off campus. So the college establishes this cost of attendance. And then in the meantime, you are completing financial aid forms. The main one is called the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. It's filled out during the senior year of high school and then every year afterward to be renewed. But it's called the FAFSA form, Free Application for Federal Student Aid. And you as parents are reporting information about your income and your assets and your student's income and your student's assets. And then the government uses a formula called federal methodology, and they calculate what I call a magic number, the expected family contribution. You'll see it referred to as the EFC. Now, some private colleges require an additional form called the CSS profile form, and they use a different formula called institutional methodology. So there are about 350 of those colleges, and they tend to be wealthier, more selective private institutions who have more of their own need-based money to give away. And so they don't want to use the federal formula. They're choosing to use this institutional formula instead. So the EFC is calculated and it's subtracted from the cost of attendance. And then the difference is your student's financial need. So once that need has been established, so let's just say the college costs $65,000 a year, your EFC is $30,000, so the need is $35,000 a year. Now, the key is, and it gets back to, it's all about the list and understanding how colleges award financial aid. The key is that not all colleges are able to meet that full demonstrated need. So while it's important to know what your EFC is, and there are calculators online that you can use, the College Board website is a great resource to go and get an estimate of your EFC. What's really important to know is, does the college meet full need, and do they meet full need for everyone? Or coming back to, your student will do better at the school where they're a strong student. When a college can't afford to meet full need for everyone, the students they're most likely to meet full need for are the ones they want to enroll the most. So get an estimate of your EFC. That's a good first step as your student is beginning the college search process. And then the other great tool that families have available today is something called a net price calculator. And all colleges are required by the government to have a net price calculator. And it's a way that you can go to any college's website, enter your income and your assets and household information, and the college will generate an estimate of how much need-based financial aid you might receive. Now, it's not a perfect estimate. It's only as good as the information that goes in. And the other piece of that is that some colleges they're not always able to incorporate merit scholarship eligibility within the net price calculator, but it's a good way for you to get a sense of what your eligibility for need-based financial aid is at different colleges.
Kathy, is there a site where you can find out, like, certain colleges will emphasize more merit, others may emphasize more need, or is it pretty much the same at most colleges, or is there really a differentiation between colleges in terms of how they award grants or aids?
That is a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because that is the crux of the issue, really. So the way I like to describe it is that there's a spectrum, and the most highly selective institutions in the country award little to no merit aid, but award very generous need-based financial aid packages. And so when you think about that, that kind of makes sense, right? Those schools don't have to entice anyone to enroll, but they have the resources to make generous need-based financial aid packages available. So the rule is the most selective institutions generally don't offer merit scholarships, but do offer generous need-based financial aid. But then there are hundreds of other institutions that offer merit scholarships and some need-based aid, but they just may not be able to meet need for everyone. So the way to get at that question is often by researching a college's website. Colleges that don't offer any merit scholarships will usually come right out and say, you know, we offer need-based financial aid, but do not offer merit scholarships. And then colleges that offer merit scholarships, which is really the majority, will often have information on their website about what their merit scholarships are, who might receive them. Some colleges are very transparent and will say, you know, if your test score is this and your GPA is this, you can expect this much in a scholarship. Other colleges will be more vague in their language about, you know, talking about high achieving students who will contribute to our community, those kinds of things. But you can get a sense on the website. The College Board website, called bigfuture.collegeboard.org. You can look up any college and you can see the profile of students who are admitted there. And then there's some financial aid summary data as well that gives you an idea about whether they offer merit scholarships. I also encourage families to ask the question when they're visiting a college. You know, it's perfectly fine to ask in an information session, do you offer merit scholarships, and can you give us an idea of what the profile is of the student who might be considered for merit scholarships? So it's really researching each institution individually, but there are some general rules out there that the most selective schools focus primarily on need-based aid and not merit scholarships.
You know, Kathy, I know when you're filling out financial aid forms and you talked about the FAFSA form, what are some of the common mistakes? And are there things, let me say, do's and don'ts that you don't want to do? In other words, are there certain things that you could do that maybe disqualify you for financial aid? And are there certain things that enhance getting that financial aid?
Well, I think the first and most important do is to meet deadlines. And the opposite of that is don't miss it. So each college, there are certainly commonalities among all the colleges. You know, all colleges will require the FAFSA for you to be considered for federal aid, including student loans. And then some colleges require the profile form. And then some colleges actually might have an institutional form. There's not very many of those, but there are some. And some may ask for tax returns throughout the process. But the first and most important thing is to research each college and make sure you're meeting the deadline, the priority deadline they've set for when they want those forms completed. Now, the process is changing starting next year. In the past, the FAFSA didn't become available until January 1st for the next year. So students who are seniors this year, they couldn't even fill out the FAFSA until January 1st to apply for next year. But starting next year, the form will become available October 1st instead. Now, as far as we know, most colleges aren't changing deadlines in significant ways. Most of the time, deadlines for need-based financial aid fall in the winter of the senior year, you know, usually February, March timeframe. So far, we haven't heard a lot of colleges changing their deadline, moving it earlier, but that doesn't mean you can't fill it out earlier, because you can, and it might give you earlier information depending on the college's process. In terms of ways to fill out the form to maximize eligibility, the formula that calculates EFC is heavily weighted toward income. So we hear a lot from families who are worried about how their savings are positioned. And we're going to talk about assets in just a sec. But the formula is heavily weighted toward income. And it's a pretty straightforward kind of a form. In fact, starting next year, because the form is available earlier, they're also asking for an earlier year of income. So when families are completing the FAFSA, they'll actually be able to just pull their income right from the IRS. So your income is what it is. So there's not much room for error there. When it comes to the asset side of the equation, on the FAFSA form, you're asked to report your assets as of the day that you're completing the form. So there's no look back. So anything that you spend prior to completing the form, no one's going to question you about that. So if you need to deplete any assets, if you have any major purchases, the time to do it is before you fill out the FAFSA. But when you complete the FAFSA, the instructions tell you do not include the equity in your primary residence and do not include the value of retirement accounts. So if there's a mistake we saw people make sometimes, it was that they included those numbers when they didn't need to. For most families, actually, most of their wealth is probably in their home or in their retirement, and those two assets are not included on the FAFSA. So that's the beginning of some do's and don'ts.
Okay. And I know there's, as we mentioned, we talked about work programs and grants, scholarships. What about also bringing down the cost of, let's say, a college education? I know that a lot of colleges are offering online courses versus the brick and mortar where, you know, junior goes away to school, lives at a dorm. So you have not only tuition and book costs, but you also have room and board. What about online universities and getting aid for that? It seems like that would help to bring some of the cost down versus, let's say, staying on campus.
It certainly can bring the cost down. It really does depend on the university and what they're charging for their cost and also what kind of aid they're offering. So what's really important is really what the net price is, obviously not the sticker price of what a college is charging. So yeah, I think online universities can be cheaper. They can be, but sometimes not. The other kinds of options, of course, are community college first and then going on to four-year colleges. I think in today's high school world, there are options that can result in college savings, things like dual enrollment, where students are enrolled in community college and high school at the same time. So they're earning credits toward a college degree. And then, of course, AP classes, advanced placement classes, and other college-level classes that are taken in high school. I think that is a great approach to take, but you will want to check with each college that your student is considering, because different colleges do have different rules about which of those courses they'll accept if you transfer them in for a four-year degree. But yeah, there's lots of creative ways to do it.
You know, we looked at this with a client of ours who had four children, and they simply just didn't have the money to send them all to college. So one of the things that we suggested is something we call our 2+2 program, where junior stays at home for 2 years, goes to a junior college at a cost of about $2,500 a year. So the first 2 years for an AA degree could be $5,000, and then a state school versus out of state or a private school where, you know, the cost may be $16,000 to $20,000. So you can get a college degree for $50,000 and less, and even online can bring that cost down even more.
Yes, for some families that can be the absolutely most affordable option. And I think to go along with that, I mean, certainly there are many states that have articulation agreements and other arrangements, you know, between the community college and the four-year state college to make sure. The general theme here is when the student goes to community college, they want to make sure that they're meeting with an advisor, that they're taking the right kinds of courses that will transfer, and that they're on a plan for the four-year degree. So they maximize those community college years and minimize the chance that it'll take them an extra semester once they get into the four-year college. But absolutely, that can be a way to save significant dollars.
You know, one of the other things that we're starting to see, and the Wall Street Journal has done a number of stories on this, a lot of the major corporations, whether it's General Electric or Apple, are working with junior colleges, and they're basically trying to come up with like a certificate programs. It reminds me back of the guild days back in the 14th century. So where you come up with some kind of program for 2 years and you come out with a skill set, whether it's computer programming, robotics or something, and can go work at, let's say, a factory and have the skill set to work in today's modern factories where robotics are taking over more of manufacturing. Are you seeing more of these kind of programs come out in the future?
Well, I don't know that I'm as well qualified to address that, but certainly I would imagine that that's something that's going to be growing in the future as we face the need for an educated workforce in particular ways. Certainly, can see that happening more and more going forward. And given the rising cost of college and how it is harder and harder for middle-income families to afford, absolutely.
So as we boil this down and kind of summarize, you mentioned a couple of key points, some do's and don'ts. One of the things that you pointed out, it's important that you meet the deadlines for filing these forms. And given that college starts, you know, usually at the end of August or early September, how much of a time frame do you have? What's the general deadline to have these applications for aid in? Obviously, if you're going to start college in the fall, you'd want to know that well in advance before attending.
Yes. Well, I will say that the traditional route for the student who's starting this August, most of the deadlines for institutional dollars anyway were in February or March of this year. And then the way the timing normally works or the process normally works is that students receive financial aid awards in March and April of their senior year. And then they have until May 1st to decide where to enroll. So the idea is that they know what it's going to cost by May 1st so that they can make their decision. Now, it is true at some state universities and certainly at community colleges, if you didn't apply by February or March, that doesn't mean you can't get money. If those colleges are awarding primarily federal and state aid or federal aid, you can still apply for federal aid this summer to attend in the fall. The issue, of course, with federal aid is that for most middle-income families, federal aid really means federal student loans. And lower-income families might qualify for federal grants. Many states, for state grant programs, they also have deadlines that fell in February or March, or sometimes a little later, of the senior year. So for kids starting this August, if you haven't applied for financial aid, certainly go ahead and do that now. But for families who are looking forward a year or two, do know that most of the time the deadlines fall during the senior year of high school so that you can get the information you need and have enough information to make an informed decision about cost and everything else by May 1st of your senior year.
As we close, Kathy, if our listeners would like to find out more about the assistance that your organization provides in attaining financial aid, how could they do so, please?
Our website is getintocollege.com. is our website. So they can certainly access that website and there's information there about how to contact our people.
Well, listen, Kathy, thanks for coming on the program and lending your assistance, because I imagine this is going to be a pretty big issue here in the next 30 days. Thanks so much and all the best. And please come back and talk to us again.
Great to talk with you.
Something that came out of this conversation, Jim, is that college, the funding of it, first of all, it's become very, very expensive, but it's also complex in how this is achieved. And one of the topics we talk about on Lifetime Income are like multi-generational families living together. And you're almost getting into the point where you're having to do multi-generational retirement planning and take all of the picture into consideration. One of which, of course, is what you're going to do to pay for your kids' education. And you can't start too early on that.
No, and as we tried to point out in the program here, one of the key things is we talk about retirement planning on the program, but the real key is financial planning for the entire lifetime, because a lot of the key decisions that you make early on in your career, when you get out of high school, what college you attend, public, private, the profession you choose, and when you start saving, as well as your lifestyle through your working career, so much of this factors into retirement planning. Unfortunately, John, most people don't start talking about retirement planning until usually in their late 40s or early 50s when the kids have grown up, you put them through school, and you're thinking, you know, I'm 10, 15 years away from retirement. We better start thinking about it, when really the time to think about it is the day you start your first job coming out of college and the decisions that you make. But anyway, in the month of May coming up, we're going to cover more of the issues of college education. It is graduation time. So funding a college education is going to be on the minds of a lot of our listeners, and we're going to have special experts here on the program. You know, a couple of areas I want to get into is the cost of a private education really worth the cost? In other words, you're going to Harvard and you're going to spend, what, $260,000, $280,000, is it worth it versus, let's say, a state university, or my own version of what I call affordable college, which is 2+2. We'll be getting more into that in the months ahead. In the meantime, well, we're out of time here on the program. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week. We'll be right back.
can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.